Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us as we go into hour number two. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Cal Mabry is at the controls this morning. Across the country, there are people who are losing their homes at a rate that has not been seen since the Great Depression, and there are a lot of people who feel that the housing market has even further to fall. Who is responsible for this? Well, there's a lot of blame to go around, but this morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a financial journalist who says a lot of the responsibility lies with some of Wall Street's biggest investment banks. Our guest is Matthew Padilla. He is a business reporter for the Orange County Register, and he is the co-author, along with Paul Muolo, of a recently published book that's titled Chain of Blame. The subtitle is How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. It's published by Wiley. And the two of them, Matthew Padilla and Paul Muolo, have been writing about this subject for and following it for quite a long time. In addition, I want to mention that Matthew Padilla, his work on the subprime crisis, has been recognized by the Society of American Business Editors and Writers. He was also nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He also hosts the popular Mortgage Insider blog website. If you're interested in mortgage-related subjects, you want to take a look at that. As we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All we ask is people just try to keep their comments brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different callers as possible. Keep things moving along. But, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Padilla, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
And I'm glad to be here.
We've done a few programs with different kinds of guests talking about this same thing, the subprime mortgage crisis. And I guess I always feel like, as much as it's been discussed, that there are still people, and I would count myself among them, who would say that we're still not exactly sure what happened here. I mean, we know what the fallout has been, but if I was to ask a question like, okay, in the simplest way possible, if I said, really, what was this subprime mortgage crisis all about? How would you answer?
Boy, I think, to make it real simple, it was about Wall Street firms finding a way that they could make money, make more money than on traditional loans. And the backstory there is that savings and loans, which people have gone to for years and years to get a home loan, you may recall It's a Wonderful Life, that nice film, mm-hmm. George Bailey, those savings and loans had problems in the 80s after deregulation. They went kind of crazy with some investments, and they also got hit by inflation in the 1970s. So basically, what happened is when they had problems, the Wall Street firms stepped in and said, "Well, we'll buy loans from you and sell those loans, and then you have cash to go out and make new home loans." And the problem became that when Wall Street found that that was an easy business with prime loans, that like 30-year fixed-rate loans that we've done for decades, it was so easy they decided to try subprime, which is basically a subprime loan is just a loan to someone who has a history of not paying his or her bills. When Wall Street first did it, they made sure that you had a lot of equity in your home. So if the home was worth, say, 100 grand, all the loans on the home should not be more than, say, 70,000. So you had a 30% equity cushion. But as time went on, they accepted less and less of that equity until they would loan you the full value of your home. And that really didn't make sense because the people had a history of not paying their bills. So that's where we went wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems that there are a number of really interesting pieces we could talk about. I guess just to pull one out, one of the things that I did find myself wondering is, if you ask what have been the significant changes in the residential real estate market within the past 10 years or something, would it be that one of the things that has changed is where it is that people went to borrow the money to buy the house?
Yes, This is really the crux of it all. As I said before, you used to go to a savings and loan or your local regional bank. But after the S&L crisis, we saw these folks called mortgage brokers. And mortgage brokers have been around for a long time. It's just that they got really big in the 1990s. And basically, a mortgage broker is someone who, in some states, is licensed, like in California, and in others, like Colorado, may be registered but not actually licensed. And the broker is someone who you go to, and the broker has the lowest interest rates from various lenders each day. So they should get you into the best deal of the day and provide a valuable service. And I've interviewed lots of brokers who do that, and I hear from their customers who like them. Unfortunately, because it can be very easy to become a mortgage broker and there isn't a strong federal regulator watching them, you get some bad apples. And on top of that, when it came to the subprime stuff, the incentives were all against the consumer. And just to make it real simple, if you have bad credit, the lender can charge you more in terms of interest rates and fees because it's harder for you to get a loan. So it's kind of a perverse thing there where you have to actually pay money even though you're probably a lower income person. Mm. So the mortgage broker had incentive to get you into that subprime loan even if maybe you could have gotten a better loan if you had done a few things or gone a different route. So the incentives were to get you into that bad loan, and then the broker would bring that loan to a lender like Countrywide, who also made more money on subprime for the same reasons, the higher interest rates and fees. Then Countrywide would sell that to Wall Street, whether it's Merrill Lynch or Bear Stearns or whoever, and they would also make more money on the subprime loan. So the whole food chain was this loose network that began with the mortgage brokers.
And that obviously here the bottom line is that all of the people in the chain, they were obviously interested in making money. They were interested in whatever fees and commissions that they could get. So all the way along that, that was what was going on, and clearly all of the people at these various places, at least at one time, maybe not now, but at least at one time, they were all making a lot of money.
Yeah. Now let's talk about that issue of making money, because every business is out to make money, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, mm-hmm. but there are things that can make it or have made it weird or perverse in home lending, and the two key things are how easy it is to get into the business. I mean, if you think about it, if some guy is going to cut your hair or some woman, that person, I think in most states, has to go through training and get a license. But if you, say, go work for a lender like Countrywide or IndyMac or one of these guys, you could be a felon and not have any license. And they weren't really required to – I mean, they should do a background check because that's smart business, but they weren't required to by law. So you could just start making home loans tomorrow for one of those wholesalers. And the other thing was most businesses have to manage risk. But the problem was when Wall Street bought the loans from lenders, they took that risk away. And so the lenders felt, well, since we're not holding the loans, we can do – whatever we want, really.
Yeah.
That turned out not to be true in the sense of when the loans started going bad, these lenders would actually borrow money to make loans, and so they couldn't borrow money anymore because Wall Street had lost face because the investors who were buying the loans realized that they weren't smart bets.
One other thing here, and that we're starting to get some callers lined up, it seems that another big change here has to do with really – I guess what I would say, and I'm not sure this is the right type of terminology, but what I would say was just explosive growth in the secondary market. And I guess I think that traditionally there might have been a time when you'd go down to the bank or to the S&L or whatever to buy a home. They would lend you the money, and they would hold the mortgage. Probably, I don't know if always, but for a long time, there has been a secondary market so that the originator of the loan maybe sold that loan on to somebody else, and it's possible they could have sold it on to somebody else. Then maybe they would have kept some of the loans but would have sold some on. It seems like the big change here is that we have loan originators who hold none of the loans, and for them, they, as you say, they sort of thought, well, if somehow this goes bad, it's not my problem because I made the money and then I passed the risk on to somebody else. And it seemed like that what was happening is that people kept thinking that they were going to be okay because they made their little bit of money, and then they continue to pass the risk on to somebody else further up the line until you get to these enormous companies who had enormous amounts of these loans that they were bundling up and turning into securities that had enormous risk, and that suddenly the whole thing came apart.
Yeah. Well, there is a fundamental problem to the holding of loans in terms of most people feel safest and most comfortable with the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The problem with that is that when you go to your bank, you give them money in terms of your checking and savings accounts, or you buy a certificate of deposit, and that has the market interest rate today. The bank makes money by making the 30-year fixed-rate loans, so it gets tied into that interest rate for 30 years. So if there's inflation and interest rates rise, the bank or the thrift has to pay the consumer more money today, but it's the loans on its books are tied at these lower rates. So long term, that's always been a problem in the business, and that is why it's one of the reasons that the government has tried to grow that secondary market. It created the FHA program during the Great Depression, and then the government created Fannie Mae to buy a loan from FHA. And then the government said that Fannie Mae and later Freddie Mac could buy more kinds of loans, but they put some restrictions. And so then Wall Street came in and said, well, where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac end, we begin. And Wall Street began buying all kinds of loans, and so to the point where we got these subprime loans, the loans where you just state your income, and the loans where you actually choose your payment, but the lowest payment is just kind of the I'll worry about it tomorrow option because you owe more to the bank. But it all gets back to the fact that if a lender holds a 30-year fixed-rate loan on its books, that's a problem for the lender long-term, if there's inflation. So it's a fundamental risk that still remains today.
So I guess then it sounds like the idea of the secondary market, that's fine, because what that means is the way it's supposed to work is that then the bank can get that loan off their books. They can get some more money, which the idea is then they turn around and they lend that out again. So that's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But then when we come down to the big problem was the people that they were here, people who were writing, who were giving loans to consumers who shouldn't have gotten those loans in the first place.
Yeah.
And so it we're back to the fact that somebody was writing these very high-risk loans to high-risk clients and thinking that they were then passing on that risk to somebody else, and somebody else accepted that risk, maybe not appreciating just how much risk they were taking on.
Yeah, and it goes back to, in this country, we have these periods where we think regulation is bad, and so Ronald Reagan, for example, deregulated savings and loans, and then we had some disasters, and so we re-regulated that industry, and then Wall Street stepped in. Bill Clinton in 1999 repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated banks and insurance companies and investment banks. So we had this financial free-for-all, and then George Bush and Alan Greenspan really kind of were almost hostile to the idea of regulation. With Alan Greenspan, he cut interest rates aggressively to deal with 9/11 and the recession, but he refused to get involved with making rules about getting a subprime loan, which the Federal Reserve has the power to do. Since Greenspan left, under the new chief, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve has led the creation of new rules, and I think within the last couple of months, they basically said no more liar's loans or stated income loans, as they're known, on the subprime stuff. If you make a subprime loan now, you have to make sure the consumer can afford the highest payment within 7 years, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're going back, once again, to regulation of some kind to avoid another fiasco. But, we should have these rules in place. These are very sensible rules. And so we should have had these rules in place, 6 years ago.
And I suppose just real quick, one other thing that entered into this, that there was a point where people were acting like, I don't know if they really believed it, but were acting like the value of property, the value of homes, would just continue to go up and up and up and up and up, and no one seemed to believe that there was ever going to come back down.
Yeah, that is, and the other thing that really boggles. I mean, I've been writing about this for like 5 or 6 years, and I still can't believe this mentality. That Angelo Mozilla, who heads Countrywide, he's the center of our book, Chain of Blame. Angelo built up Countrywide over a 40-year history to the largest lender in this nation, to the point where one out of every five people got a home loan through Countrywide. Mm-hmm. So he'd been through cycles. I mean, he'd seen the market go up and down and up and down and up and down. So I don't know why he didn't want to believe that this last cycle was not going to have a very severe correction if home prices went up so dramatically. In California, just to give you an example, where I live in Orange County, south of Los Angeles, our median home price, which is like an average, was around $300,000 in, say, 2002. And by 2006, it was $600,000 for like your average-priced home. Mm-hmm. I mean, so a correction was coming, and now our median price is like $475,000. So, you know, it's been harsh.
Yeah, we have a couple callers. I'll get right to them. For everybody else, I just better introduce again our guest, Matthew Padilla. He's a business reporter for the Orange County Register, and he is the co-author, along with Paul Muola, of the book Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. It's published by Wiley, out in the bookstore now. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a couple of callers. They're both here in Urbana, where we are. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Hi, David. I was getting the idea that maybe this is just a conversation between you and the author. If I can remember what I wanted to say now, it seems to me that this is part of the whole deal where banks get to rob the people instead of the other way around by having trick mortgages where the payments balloon. It seems to me that if you do that sort of thing and you have unsophisticated borrowers, that the bank is assuming and the lenders are assuming that they'll get the property back and they can resell it. Bill Moyers had a really good program about banks robbing people and has had several programs, actually. There was one that, this is on Friday nights here locally, showing what has happened to Cleveland because of the foreclosures. The houses don't get resold. They get vandalized, stripped, made worthless. And now several parts of the country have whole areas where the buildings are going to need to be torn down. And it's not only the banks and the individuals involved, it's whole communities that are being affected by this rapacious lending that's going on. And we're not just talking about mortgages, we're talking about things like credit cards, where banks can change the terms. If you're late on a payment to your power bill, they can raise your interest rate. And they fought Truth in Lending so that people would have some clue how much they were actually paying over time to repay their loans. I have a relative who works in the data mining business. He works for a company that doesn't deal with this sort of thing, but he said a lot of people that he knew that had his training were all talking about going into the subprime lending business and companies that did that because that's where there's lots of money to be made for all kinds of people. It's just, we have a country that talks about family values and we don't talk about not allowing capitalists to be loan sharks. There used to be usury laws, and now we let banks charge phenomenal rates for somebody who has, isn't sophisticated and doesn't have, who gets stuck in this borrowing business. So that's my little rant for this morning. Thanks for listening.
All right. Well, Mr. Padilla, you can respond to any part of that you like.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that the caller is right on the money. But before I attack lenders and brokers, I will say that I've met many consumers in during reporting on the book and with my newspaper. and some were willing to take the stated income loans and exaggerate their income because they really wanted a house. There was sort of like this mentality: if you didn't get in now, you would never get in, and you would never be able to own a home. And I've interviewed people who have good jobs and make six-figure incomes, but stretched maybe with an interest-only loan or a stated income loan or an interest-only stated income loan. So they bear some of the responsibility for that, and they may have actually lied about their income, which is a misrepresentation. It's fraud, and it's a federal offense. However, I think your caller is right about everything else. The system was so unregulated, and the incentives on subprime so great that it did attract just about anyone. I mean, I interviewed people who worked at some of these shops, like New Century and AmeriQuest. Those were two of the biggest subprime lenders that were based. They were based in my neck of the woods, but they're the largest. They were the largest subprime lenders in the nation. And their employees may not have graduated from high school. They may have been selling cars and seeing how much money there was to be made, because the guys who bought the fancy cars were in the mortgage business, so they wanted to get into the mortgage business. And anyone could get into it if you went directly to work for one of these shops. As I said, you did not need to be licensed, and there was no law that required a background check. So yes, and yes, there was sort of this lack of morality in that part of the business, and it was borne out in the AmeriQuest settlement. AmeriQuest was the largest subprime lender in the country. They settled with 49 states to 300 without admitting guilt. They paid $325 million to settle charges with attorneys general. And basically, what it all came down to with the AmeriQuest case was that you had these guys who would get you into a loan, and then at the last minute, allegedly, they would swap the terms on you. There were reports of maybe you using like a Coke machine to put a document and forge someone's signature, because you could kind of see through the paper because of the light on the Coke machine. So fraud, bait and switch. Also, these guys could make their big fat commissions on the subprime loans and other risky debt. I think your caller is right.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else. This is also Urbana and line two. Hello.
I gather from your conversation that there is no statute regarding the criminality of the mortgage broker, whose first and primary responsibility is to make sure that they can indeed, the buyer can indeed afford to make the payments. But I also infer that we are going back to a regulation and a self-evident statute of that nature. Is that correct?
Yeah. This is Matt. There's two key things. One is the mortgage broker or loan officer, does he or she have a fiduciary responsibility to the consumer? And that's been very much up for debate. Here in California, I still don't think that's really clear cut. In other cases, with other professionals, like an attorney, they do have a fiduciary duty. In terms of can you actually afford the loan, no, there has been no law that said that they could not make you a loan that you could afford today, but not in, say, a year. That was totally legal. And as I said earlier during our conversation, it's now a little bit harder with the subprime stuff. Those are loans to people with bad credit. The Federal Reserve counts subprime not by credit profile, but by how much interest rate you pay. So if you pay a higher interest rate, then the lender and broker have to make you a loan that you can afford the highest payment within 7 years. And so that was a recent change. But still, if you've got good credit, I guess they could charge you a loan that you can't afford after the teaser rate ends. So it remains a very mixed bag.
doesn't the mortgage broker hold the primary responsibility, though, because this financial collapse would not have happened if they wouldn't have not signed up people who could not pay?
Yes, and no, I agree. The mortgage broker does hold the primary responsibility, and the problem is that brokers have been licensed or unlicensed, depending on which state you live in. In Colorado, as I mentioned earlier, they used to not be even registered. Then they passed a law saying they could be registered but didn't have to be licensed. There has been a move towards a national, at least, registration system. I don't think that's been put into place yet, but that could happen. I think a national licensing system is both appropriate and, or at least every state should be required to license mortgage brokers, so you can, you know, look them up online and see if there's been complaints and if they have a license. In California, you can do that with brokers and real estate agents, but not in certain other states. So, yeah, we need to make some improvements to that system.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just real quick, before I go on to another caller, I'd like to introduce again our guest. He's a business writer, Matthew Padilla. He's business reporter for the Orange County Register. He is also the co-author, along with Paul Mualo, of the book Chain of Blame: How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis, published by Wiley. The two of them have been writing about this story for a number of years now. Matt's work on the subprime crisis was recognized by the Society of American Business Editors and Writers and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He also hosts the popular Mortgage Insider blog website. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go on here. We have another caller, someone listening in Charleston, line number three.
Yeah, I have a question, and one question is about, I've seen there's a place in North Texas, South Oklahoma, that has a rent-to-own, it's called a real estate solutions company, and they do rent-to-owns, and I guess they assume payments so you don't lose your house to mortgages. And second is, what happens to all these people that were foreclosed? In fact, there was a story in our paper a few weeks ago that the people that lost their homes to foreclosures, no landlords would rent to them, and they had to stay in motels, which are ungodly expensive. But how do these people then get housing if they can't rent, you know, find a place to rent because of their foreclosure status? What is the solution to all these people that may essentially be homeless? And is this mortgage credit crisis, is it ever going to flatten out, straighten out over the next few years?
Okay, well, there are three questions. I don't know what you can take them on in the order, I guess.
Sure. You know, the rent-to-own stuff, I haven't seen that in California, so I think I'll pass on that one. Although, as a general statement, I've seen everything under the sun in real estate, and I would be very, very careful and read the fine print on any kind of unusual deal that people want to offer you. In terms of the foreclosure question, that's a really good one that I can answer. A foreclosure is one of the worst things you can do to your credit, the worst being a bankruptcy. To try to avoid foreclosure, people should contact their lender as soon as possible. Lenders are more willing to make deals so that you can stay in your home. Usually what the lender will do is lower your interest rate the lender will try to get you on a plan to kind of spread out payments that you've missed over a longer period. Sometimes that's not enough, and so in an extreme case, they may lower the amount you owe or extend the term of the mortgage, like to 40 years or 50 years. But those are very hard to get. And the reason is that the lender thinks if they cut the interest rate for, like, let's say 2 years or 5 years, that's a temporary problem, and they'll still get their money back. But if they lower the principal, that's permanent, and they've kind of written off that money, so they're very reluctant to do that. If they do foreclose, if you're unable to avoid foreclosure, your credit will take a hit. So, I mean, my advice is go rent an apartment before that happens. Although the foreclosure process in some states can take a year, and you still have a six-month right of redemption, so the lender might not actually foreclose for 18 months. So you could live rent-free if you really can't afford your home. I mean, that's kind of unethical, I guess, but, I mean, you can do it. Here in California, they can kick you out in about 4 months. But usually they don't file, usually they don't initiate the foreclosure process until you've missed about three payments. So that's about a seven-month window where you can live without paying your bills if you're really in a jam. You know, once there's been a foreclosure, if you're having trouble getting an apartment, I mean, that can happen, and there really isn't anything that can be done. You just have to keep trying and maybe live with friends or relatives for a while. It's definitely something that's hitting folks right now. Maybe if you explain the situation to your landlord, you can get around that. The last question about when this will end, that is the million-dollar question. And in our book, we say, you know, get ready for 10 bad years of housing. And we've already had, you know, almost two here, so maybe eight more. And the reason for that is that there's three things. One is that the system in this country to make home loans right now is broken. I mean, we let Wall Street take over the business of making home loans in America. And right now, Wall Street isn't buying loans. So lenders have these loans on their books they can't sell, and at the same time there's this rise in foreclosures at record numbers, so the lenders have to shore up their own capital, and they are very reluctant to loan money unless you have great credit. The second thing is the foreclosures themselves, that we've broken here in California all records during, like, say, the slump of the 1990s, and they keep coming, wave after wave of foreclosures. Month after month, they're just crashing on our beaches. So it's going to take a long time to work through that incredible inventory. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is, usually how this works is you get a recession, and then people can't pay their bills because they've lost their job or they haven't gotten a raise, and that kept up with inflation. And so then they don't pay their mortgage, and then they foreclose. So usually you get a housing downturn after a recession. In this case, the housing downturn began. It's pulling the economy kind of to a halt, which would mean if we go into recession, as many predict, people will lose their jobs, and then that will lead to more foreclosures and an extension of the housing downturn. So for those three reasons, you know, I'm sorry to say that it looks gloomy going forward. I hope we can find a market bottom in 2 to 3 years. And then kind of just plateau at the bottom for a while, and then rebound. But it could be straight down for 4 to 5 years if we get a recession, as some predict.
I think it's interesting, as I'm sure that some people would say, well, if the economy hadn't been so bad, maybe we could have weathered this better. But what you're saying is that one of the reasons the economy is so bad is that we had the real estate collapse first, and that maybe things weren't all that great, but it accelerated the downturn in the economy.
Yeah, the debt on homes has more than doubled to, I think, something like $10 trillion. People owe more on their homes than the U.S. government owes. I think the government owes somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 trillion or something like that. And part of that was the equity extraction. Subprime lending was always about you need money because you've got some kind of hardship, so you take money out of your home to finance, and you spend that money to pay off your credit card bills or a medical bill that was unexpected, or because you lost your job and you need to survive for a while. So the equity extraction became sort of self-fulfilling, where they would get you into a loan that's fixed for a year or two, and then your payment would jump, and then you would refinance because you couldn't afford the higher payment, and then you would take more money out of your home, and you would essentially live off your home. So that mentality helped the economy in the sense that people spent money and could keep spending money on iPods and, you know, whatnot, Hummers. So that whole system is shut down now. In fact, lenders, I've been reporting on lenders like Washington Mutual, Bank of America, and various other lenders actually doing these widespread nets where they say, okay, let's say all homes in your area, our computer models say they've gone down 20%. So we're going to cut off your home equity line of credit or reduce it by that amount. And some people have found that they got a home equity line of credit because they wanted a rainy day fund in case of an emergency. And here we are in a slowing economy. It's raining, and they can't go borrow money off their home equity line of credit. So it's just a self-fulfilling cycle, and that's going to hit the economy.
Yeah, well, that you touch on something there, I think, is also, and you deal with it, is also really significant, too, and that is the growth of the home equity loan, something that there would have been a time when there just weren't that many of these things. People who were going to try to get a second mortgage, the terms weren't very good. It was something that people looked at as sort of an emergency kind of a thing. And then we got into the point where, and maybe again it was banks were making money this way, they got people into this frame of mind that they thought of their home as like an ATM machine, that they could crank cash out of it. And they weren't taking that money to make improvements in the home, which would theoretically add to its value. Maybe that would have been okay. But they were taking that money and they were, you know, who knows what they were doing. They were going on vacation or they were buying cars or they were paying off existing debt. And that was something also that was really new.
Yeah, it is. And this is what troubles me really the most about America right now is that, you know, it's getting away from the fiscal responsibility of old where you sort of, your dream was to own a home and pay off the home. Now, that was the American dream. And then when you retire, you don't have a mortgage to worry about. And that's the perfect time because then the interest deduction you get on your taxes isn't really necessary because, you know, your income is lower. You live off your savings and Social Security, and you don't have that high paycheck from your job. So you don't need the deduction. So that's how things have been working for decades. But then over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 maybe 20 years, but definitely over the last five, for sure, we got into this mentality of living off the house and taking money off the house and buying more home than we could afford long term. And by when I say me, I mean a wide swath of Americans. There is there remains one silver lining in the cloud. Census data does show that something like, I want to say 40% of Americans have no debt on their property. So there are still like a core of homeowners. I think these tend to be older folks who didn't get into this whole, you know, let's live off the house mentality and maintain their conservative values. So it's not as bad as, say, the Great Depression, where I think like half the outstanding loans went bad. But it doesn't look good, and we got ourselves into this mess.
Yeah. It's going back to Wall Street and the piece there. You were talking earlier right at the beginning about the fact that we got this big problem because we had big Wall Street investment firms with money to invest who initially was one of the things that maybe they did was that they lent money to lenders who then turned around and lent that out for mortgages and that initially this was more conventional lenders and conventional loans and that the Wall Street firms discovered that was so easy that it made them so much money. They said, well, let's get into this even more. And they got involved in subprime, much higher risk loans. And then they also took those loans, bundled up these loans, and then created these securities that were backed by these huge bundles of subprime loans that then turned out to be a real problem when people defaulted on their loans and the value of the property crashed. And all of this, you'd have to ask, well, surely there were people who were working for these firms whose job it was to assess risk and who should have looked at their involvement in subprime loans and the fact that they were very, very heavily relying on these things that were potentially shaky. Someone should have said, now, wait a minute, this is not a good idea. This is not prudent. This could turn really bad and we could lose a lot of money. Why did they seem to do such a poor job of assessing the risk of these things?
Well, this is probably one of the most interesting parts of our book, and we kind of take you into the inside story here. You know, the Wall Street firms, they live to trade things and make their money off of trades. They don't have experience really dealing with consumers as much, except for the stock brokerage shops like Merrill Lynch. So For the home loans, what they would do was they would lend money to these lenders, and then they would buy the loans from the lenders because they had a relationship. But, you know, Wall Street wanted to keep its headcount low. So instead of reviewing the loans itself, it would hire third-party firms. Basically, you know, Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, they all knew that they maybe couldn't trust these subprime shops, or that the subprime shops might be sloppy. And these are the mortgage companies that made the subprime loans. So the Wall Street firms hired these third-party companies. The two biggest were the Bohan Group and Clayton Holdings. And for our book, we interviewed about a dozen people with those two companies, and the employees generally said they were under a lot of pressure to review loans quickly. The quota was, you know, one loan per hour. And if you think about all the documents that go into a loan, things that could go wrong, an hour is not a long time if there's some kind of red flag. I mean, it would get to the point where there was this boiler room mentality that they would all be huddled in a conference room of some lender, and suddenly a supervisor would stand up on a table or a desk and start screaming his head off, saying, you know, approve more loans or you're all fired. It was that type of boiler room. And just incredible. If you think about the old days where you went to the savings and loan and they got to know you and you put money down, basically we got away from loan underwriting and the whole thing became a retail volume business where it's volume, volume, volume. And these people at the Bohan Group and Clayton Holdings told us they had to move quickly. I interviewed kind of he wouldn't go on the record, but I interviewed a top guy at one of those two firms to kind of respond to these charges. And basically what he told me was they themselves, you know, had really experienced people in the beginning, say 2002, reviewing these loan files. But by 2004 or 5, the demand was so intense that they kind of had to grab people with less experience. And that was a big part of the problem of why so many bad loans got through the system. It's just everybody was sort of drunk on volume and commissions. And, you know, sensible underwriting went out the window. And that's why we are where we are today.
Yeah. Got about 5 minutes left. Again, our guest is Matthew Padilla. He is the co-author of the book Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. He's a business writer for the Orange County Register. We have another caller here. I want to make sure we get him in.
Okay.
In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Matthew Padilla, good morning.
Good morning.
The most successful use of land so far for poor people has been land trusts. And we can start with Vermont. We can go to a lot of places where the trust is taken away from corporations. The houses are owned by the individuals and can be passed on. But the land is owned by the trust itself. And they're not owned by the banks. The trusts are held by banks, but they cannot be managed by the banks. They're managed by the individuals. And the only exception to this would, of course, be the Eloise Cobell versus Kemptone case of the Blackfeet Nation, who have been totally robbed by government mismanagement of the Blackfeet Indian Land Trust. Now, how can we possibly correct this without a third party in Congress and a third party in the presidency? Now, this is the maximum program that will nationalize the banks, nationalize all of the banking industries, open up the books to the public, and make Congress allow Congress to see all of the of where the money goes. And thank you for taking my question.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you maybe in someday in an alternate universe you might see that kind of transparency. Would you ever expect such a thing?
Yeah, I would hope so, but I would find it difficult to envision. You know, land trusts sound like a great deal, and I've always heard good things about them. In California, we don't really have too much of that, and one of the reasons is because at least where in the areas that I've lived and covered, the population density is too great. I think they work best where you've got some land to kind of play with. But you know, the movement has been like for as long as Bush has been in office, he does not support adding more regulation. He's kind of reluctantly under Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, allowing for a little bit more involvement here because he recognizes we could have a financial meltdown. But as to your caller, you know, maybe you know, if Democrats sweep, and I'm not saying that they will, but if they did, it would be more likely that we would get the kind of regulation that he's talking about. You know, and we do need innovative programs to help poorer folks. I've dealt locally with some written about some nonprofit consumer counseling groups that have been buying up foreclosures and doing some work on them and then selling them cheaply to people who need housing, lower income people. You know, the problem is that in that case, the nonprofits have limited funding, and really the funding is always the key question. You want to provide more affordable housing, but where is the money going to come from? So whether it's land trusts or what I'm talking about, I think funding is always at the bottom of it. And we just, you know, I don't want to pay more taxes, but I do want to see people help. So it's just a fundamental issue that just goes on and on.
We just have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. And I guess one of the things that maybe I'd have you talk about just a little bit here at the end, admitting here I'm not really giving you enough time, is, you know, what's happened to some of the people who were so heavily into this business? And there is one guy, one character among the interesting characters in the book that is maybe a standout character, Angelo Mozillo, the guy who was the CEO of Countrywide, who just a remarkable character. This is one of those people that if you made him up, people would say, oh, you were going over the top. The real guy is like an amazing. So his story is just completely amazing.
Our narrative builds all around him. We tell his life story. And just quickly, he was a guy who grew up in the Bronx. His dad was a butcher. He used to work in the shop. His dad actually had a heart attack when an inspector came to the shop. Angelo was the first guy in his family to go to college. He really wanted to be successful. He built up Countrywide over four decades to the point where it made one in every five loans in America. He was also a guy that was feared. He had a temper, and once an analyst that didn't even cover the company, you know, would not give me a quote about Angelo because he feared retribution in some kind of vague form. Angelo was forced out of Bank of America forced out of Countrywide when Bank of America bought Countrywide in early July for really pennies on the dollar. They paid a few billion, and Countrywide has hundreds of billions in the assets. At the same time, that could be a black hole for Bank of America because we don't know how many loans are going bad and how many lawsuits there are and what the settlements will be. So Bank of America bit off a big chunk there, but I hope they know what they're doing. And if they do know what they're doing, Bank of America will be the largest home lender in America in the next boom. Lastly, I don't know what Angelo's doing, going to do now. You know, we do see figures have second acts, like, you know, President Nixon had a sort of second act, and so is Michael Milken of the junk bonds. He's had some nonprofit with prostate cancer that he suffered from. So I think Angelo will be back. I don't think he'll be running a company per se, although I don't know, I think he's around 60, so I guess he could. You do see older CEOs, that chapter will be written by somebody else.
Mm. Well, did he end, obviously he ended up losing heavily. I mean, he at one time was, you know, this was a very big company. It was worth a lot of money, and then it went into the tank where it was worth almost nothing.
But he, with the salaries, bonuses, and what he cashed out, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 to $300 million in those last a few years. He did hold stock that you know became almost worthless, I think he had a very golden parachute. I think he's got money to.
Okay, so don't cry for Angelo. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about him. But you know, the more troublesome is the federal prosecutions. The feds have said they're looking at something like a dozen companies. The only perp walk we saw was Ralph Chiaffi, the one who managed the two hedge funds for Bear Stearns that imploded last year. But these investigations take time. I think with Enron, it was like a 3 to 5 year time frame. So whether Angelo will ever be arrested or prosecuted is very open. And we don't, in our book, allege he committed any illegal acts. It's more like we tell his story, and our stories about growth and then irresponsibility at the end. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Interesting, Lev, he was also the co-founder of IndyMac.
Yes. That was a company they created to do alternative lending, and then they kind of sold off. Angelo's partner, David Loeb, served on the board of IndyMac, and IndyMac, as we all know, was seized by regulators recently, last month.
Last month, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a total fiasco because, you know, Sheila Blair, the head of the FDIC, has said it's very hard to find a buyer for IndyMac deposits because IndyMac used these broker deposits where people, these rich investors, shop around each day for the highest yields. So IndyMac didn't have a core customer base, and that's really that and all the Alt-A creative lending it did that's now going bad. For those two reasons, it's kind of a black hole for the federal government.
Well, there, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. You want to read more on the subject, you look for the book we've been talking about. The title is Chain of Blame, the subtitle How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis, published by Wiley. Co-author, our guest this morning, Matthew Padilla. He's a business reporter for the Orange County Register. He also hosts the popular Mortgage Insider blog website. And Mr. Padilla, thanks very much.
And take care.
Okay.